it's so hard to pressure Israel. And what can you do? What can still be done to pressure Israel? I think this is pressuring is absurd. They can and they need to force Israel. And so my question to you is, if somebody were to present themselves to you, Michael, like, I don't know, not the U.S. government or the Canadian government or the European Union or one of those forces, and they asked you, what's your agenda or your formula for ending the conflict, you know, aside from pressuring Israel, which really serves no purpose? How do we force them? How do we make them end their war? What would you say?
First of all, we have to accept that Israel is a bad faith occupier, that Israel is in defiance of numerous Security Council resolutions, General Assembly resolutions, resolutions from the UN Human Rights Council, and that it has no right to continue this occupation any longer. Second of all, we have to accept that Israel will take no steps to unwind the occupation and enable Palestinian self-determination unless it is made to do so by the international community in general and the global north in particular. And there's no way that would wind up happening unless there are sanctions, divestment, boycotts, you heard me, BDS, imposed on Israel.
That was David Kattenberg's Green Planet Monitor. Find the archives at greenplanetmonitor.net, at harbingermedianetwork.com, or wherever you get your podcasts. You listen to Harbinger Showcase on your local campus and community radio station. Coming up next. Launching October 2024, news criticism podcast, The North State, features New Haven, Connecticut-based journalist Scott Martin punching through the noise biweekly and tackling how news media frames issues, omits information, and pushes the status quo, like on this recent episode walking through the effect of the Online News Act on pushing Canadian news habits to the right and asking what implications it has for our politics. Now, here's Scott.
The North State is a proud member of the Harbinger Media Network. Well, it's done. Canada finally has a new government. Prime Minister Mark Carney is leading a minority Liberal government. Pierre Poilievre, though shaken by the loss of his seat in Carleton, seems to be comfortably regrouping. The NDP has been, for all intents and purposes, obliterated. Overall, the electorate shifted to the right. Everyone's talking about how Conservatives blew the lead, even though they had a pretty good result. But something I mentioned in passing on the North State seems to largely have fallen into the background in reporting. Remember, this is the first federal election that took place since the passing of the Online News Act. The act that led Meta to ban Canadian access to news from Facebook and Instagram, and led Google to an agreement that would see them pay $100 million to the Canadian Journalism Collective, the CJC being the organization created expressly to distribute funds collected under the act. News distortion under this new status quo has become a real problem in Canada. We are in a terrible spot overall, and it doesn't seem like any solution is coming. This is the North State. Let's take this back a bit. The biggest stories of any election cycle, obviously, are the debates. Canada had two debates this federal election, held back-to-back, French for the first one, then English for the second. In all honesty, they were kind of bland. Some fun moments were here and there for live watchers, but overall, the English language often repeated much of the same content from the French language. However, it was what happened after the debate that drew the focus to the news industry. For those unaware, Rebel Media is a far-right outlet that purports itself as news under Rebel News. I'll get to that later, so just hold on. Ezra Levant, the founder of Rebel Media, hired Kian Bexty, who went off to found The Countersignal, another far-right outlet. Bexty also founded Juno News with Candace Malcolm, who herself is the founder of True North, another right-wing outlet. Okay, I know that was a lot, but the point was to show how closely knit these outlets are. As a result, 6 out of 17 reporters who asked questions of the leaders after the federal French language debate came from Rebel, Juno, and True North. For the mathematically challenged like myself, that's about 35% of questions being asked by a far-right outlet. It was as though it couldn't get worse. But that's exactly what it did. The next night, there wasn't even a post-debate media scrum. It was canceled. Can you guess why? Well, you don't need to guess, because I'll read a couple headlines. From the Globe and Mail, post-debate press scrum scrapped at last minute over lack of, quote, proper environment. From CTV News, post-leaders debate scrums canceled due to security concerns. From antihate.ca, post-debate question period canceled due to, quote, security concerns. Okay, turns out you probably would need to guess if you just read those headlines. Here's what's been reported.
About the middle of the debate, we were getting word that those post-debate press conferences could have been canceled. And then immediately following it, Michel Cormier, who's the executive director of the Leaders Debate Commission, did go before reporters to say that, yes, in fact, they would not be able to hold them, saying that they didn't feel they could actually properly guarantee a secure environment.
Mike Le Couture, the CTV reporter you just heard, described in more detail afterwards that some members of these right-wing media groups were following media workers, loading up their gear, cameras, and microphones shoved in their face the whole time. So here's what we know from the reporting, and I'll stick with Le Couture for now. He said that they were, quote, trying to grandstand in the center, and insisted that they had a right to ask questions, that the system was undemocratic, yada yada yada. David Cochran on CBC News described Levant's attempt earlier in the night to interrupt their broadcast. Evan Balgord, writing for the Canadian Anti-Hate Network, goes into more detail, gathering many different aspects of the night, including Hill Times reporter Stuart Benson pointing out Ezra Levant owns both Rebel Media and For Canada, which is registered with Elections Canada. Ethan Cox of Ricochet Media also confronted Levant about their questions, saying, quote, you created a circus here. So in short, Ezra Levant and his friends at other far-right outlets loudly and repeatedly complained that they weren't allowed to ask their questions so hard that it hit the point where Executive Director of the Leaders' Debate Commission, Michel Cormier, shut it down. He said they couldn't, quote, guarantee a proper environment for this activity. Important to this story is that Levant and Rebel News had won the legal right to be there. Speaking to CTV News before the English language debate, Cormier reminded the audience that the commission had declined accreditation to Rebel in 2019 and 2021 and was sued successfully in both cases, so they lost both times. In short, the government has no jurisdiction to decide who is and isn't a journalist. That was essentially the ruling. But Levant runs a news organization, as well as an organization explicitly meant to participate in partisan activities. That organization had paid Rebel Media $150,000 since their inception, and just over $96,000 were for consulting fees. To anyone who has seen Rebel personalities out in the wild, their whole playbook appears to be like this. Step 1. Ask outrageous questions. Step 2. Accept answers that align with the premise of the question, and use those that don't as proof of deception. Step 3. If answer is boring or things just aren't going your way, make a scene so you can fundraise off of it on your website. Step 4. Profit. So Rebel Media and their friends were a bunch of disruptive jerks. Big news there. But what strikes me about these two incidents is that they are almost entirely discussed in isolation. As mentioned in the cold opening, this was the first federal election since the passing of the Online News Act and the subsequent Meta News ban. So, what do we know about how the news ban has affected habits of people consuming news? Well, here are some reports. The Media Ecosystem Observatory surveyed almost 1,500 Canadian adults in July of 2024 and examined social media data over 4 weeks in 2023, then in the same time a year later. Here are some of their findings. Canadian news outlets lost 85% of their engagement on Facebook and Instagram, leading to an overall decrease of 43%. The Canadian public is seeing less news, with an estimated reduction of 11 million views a day. Moreover, most Canadians don't even know there is a ban. Only 22% of Canadians knew that Facebook and Instagram had banned news. So, with those two findings in mind, here's an instructive quote. Canadians continue to learn about politics and current events through Facebook and Instagram, but through a more biased and less factual lens than before, and many Canadians do not even realize the shift has occurred. They do not appear to be seeking news elsewhere. One area that news continues to be shared is in screenshots. Now, that report was released in August of 2024. The Media Ecosystem Observatory released another report on March 11th of 2025. They note three major changes in how Canadians consume news. We already talked about the meta ban. The second change is that X, the Everything app, has deprioritized links, removed trust and safety mod teams, and fostered an environment leading to, quote, a decline in trust, the spread of hate speech and conspiracy theories, and the departure of many journalists and experts from the platform. Well, I would hardly consider myself an expert, but I appreciate the nod either way. And finally, TikTok has become an important place for news and politics to be shared in Canada. All these factors have created an environment where these are the findings. Conservative politicians had 61% more engagement than Liberal and NDP politicians combined in 2024. On X, the Everything app, federal conservative politicians have had a 52% increase since Musk took charge, and right-wing accounts get the majority of their engagement on the platform. Meta has been, quote, almost completely replaced by TikTok for major and better resourced Canadian outlets. Smaller outlets have not had a successful pivot to TikTok. So from these two reports, we have two conclusions. Canadians are less informed, and the information they do receive has shifted significantly to the right. So, now, let's talk about this election. In late March, James Temperton at The Logic reported that Canada Proud, a right-wing organization, had 31 of the top 50 viewed posts mentioning Mark Carney, Liberal leader, in the span of a week. These posts were viewed more than 1.58 million times worldwide. Numbers about its reach in Canada aren't available, but we can comfortably assume a large chunk of that was in the country. On Instagram, they achieved 36 of the top 50 posts in the same week, with a view count of over 532,000. It's important at this point to be clear. Sharing misinformation or disinformation is not the monopoly of any one political persuasion. However, it's equally important to point out that conservatives are more likely to share misinformation, and right-wing social accounts do that a lot. In fact, a report published in the Journal of Marketing found that conservatives are more likely to spread misinformation when they're in a politically polarized situation. Not only that, but a study of over 66,000 people found that those who had a harder time determining between real and fake news were, among other things, more conservative. In 2022, a Squamish municipal election was subjected to an online propaganda campaign. One website was found to be funded by an energy company. Another group pushing disinformation had spent almost $80,000 in Facebook ads. Another was spreading a, quote, anonymous and unsubstantiated sexual assault allegation against a mayoral candidate who had refused donations and meetings from developers. In other words, we're in the shit. Ads attempting to link Mark Carney to Jeffrey Epstein were launched by Canada Proud. An AI photo of him, Tom Hanks, and Ghislaine Maxwell went viral on X, the Everything app. A liberal boomer being harassed by the far right threw up two middle fingers. It was reported on by a bunch of right-wing media orgs, from The Spectator and The Toronto Sun to Rebel News and other right-wing bought a checkmark types. He and other people there say convoy types were calling people in line pedophiles, using megaphones, and filming them with their phones. On TikTok, spam accounts were pushing election narratives. 0.2% of users in a sample of 424,000 were responsible for 15% of all spam comments. Here's something else important, reported by The Pivot. Quote, the official accounts of Canadian political parties are almost absent from the analysis. This is because neither the Conservative Party of Canada, nor the Liberal Party of Canada, nor the Bloc Québécois have an official account on TikTok. The Green Party, as well as the NDP and Jagmeet Singh, do, but they apparently didn't stand out in the study. Just in case your brain glazed over because of all those numbers I threw at you, I'm going to play the Dean scream so you start paying attention again. Try to keep up. Anyway, the long and short of it is this. Since the Online News Act and the general slant of social media to the right, our society has become less informed and more susceptible to misinformation. Couple that with the absolutely devastating state of journalism institutions as a whole. Chorus, which owns Global News, is in dire financial straits. It laid off a lot of employees last year and aggressively cut costs just to stay afloat. Bell Media cut 4,800 jobs in February of last year and listed 45 of its 103 radio stations for sale. Post Media, the parent company of the National Post, bought Saltwire in August of last year, bringing another regional news outlet under the company's control. In the 2023-2024 fiscal year, CBC paid out $18.4 million in bonuses to 1,200 employees. $3.3 million went to only 45 executives. This was the same year they laid off 141 employees and eliminated 205 vacant positions. All this to say, our news ecosystem is crumbling, and hurried along by the rightward shift of social media and the banning of news on Meta platforms, right-wing activist groups are filling the void. Rebel media-affiliated reporters asking a disproportionate amount of questions after the French language debate wasn't an anomaly. It's the natural extension of this media ecosystem. And whether they know it or not, Canadians think so too. A Ledger poll that surveyed over 1,500 people found that the majority of Canadians believe disinformation and misinformation had an impact on the election. Only 9% said it had no impact. Now, this was an online poll, so take it with a little grain of salt. But it aligns with what people are seeing. There's a very good piece in Ricochet about this by Taylor C. Noakes that I'll link to in the show notes. But the reach of these far-right outlets and the legitimizing effect given to them by the Conservative Party has raised the profiles of both. One part of Noakes' article addresses that this is likely pulling the broader news media ecosystem to the right in a misguided attempt to go where they think the stream is flowing. I'm going to quote a paragraph at length here. I think it applies to both Noakes' article, obviously, as well as what we're talking about here. Quote, "A combination of factors, the disintegration of the left's traditional power base, coupled with the disintegration of Canada's press, is tied to the exploitation of social ills, pervasive economic instability, and a multi-generational fear of the future. It has created conditions ideal for the exploitation of people's worst instincts by opportunistic ideologues at home and abroad. But while legacy media and political parties point to the danger of foreign political interference, it is worth considering that the underlying conditions that allowed for the growth of Canada's far-right media and the politicians who have used it to become impossibly popular are entirely homegrown."
There's a highlight from a recent episode of The North State. Find new episodes at host Scott Martin's thecatch.ca Substack and hear the rest of the conversation at harbingermedianetwork.com. You listen to Harbinger Showcase on your local campus and community radio station. I'm Andre Goulet in Montreal. And finally, Pull Back has been exploring ideas that address global problems like inequality and climate change with hosts Kyla Hewson in Vancouver and Kristen Pugh in Ottawa since 2019. On this highlight from a recent episode, Climate Justice Montreal joins Kristen and Kyla to make the case for why public transit shouldn't just be affordable, but free for all, and how a fare-free system isn't just a dream, it's a practical step towards more just, sustainable cities. Now, here's Kristen and Kyla.
Public transit in Canada is in crisis. Between chronic underfunding, decreasing ridership, and really outdated and crumbling, I would say, infrastructure, it's becoming increasingly difficult for urban residents to rely on transit, while rural areas often have no options at all. Could making public transit free be a climate solution that also addresses social inequities?
Welcome to Pullback, where we ask experts to explain big ideas so you get the full story behind the hype. Pullback is a proud member of the Harbinger Media Network of progressive Canadian podcasts. I'm Kyla Hewson, and I'm here with my co-host, Kristen Pugh.
On today's episode, we spoke with Rubens and Christian, who are organizers with Climate Justice Montreal, which is a group that's pursuing environmental and climate justice through education, mobilization, and collective action in solidarity with directly affected communities.
In this conversation, Rubens and Christian make the case for why public transit shouldn't just be affordable, it should be free for all. Free transit reduces carbon emissions, eases traffic congestion, and improves noise and air pollution. It removes financial barriers, helping low-income riders, students, and seniors get where they need to go. This episode explores how a fare-free system isn't just a dream, it's a practical step toward more just and sustainable cities. Let's get started.
Why is public transportation important for a just transition away from fossil fuels?
I'll just start us off by saying that, like, in Quebec, 40% of greenhouse gas emissions are from transportation. And then nationally, it's 23%. And then 70% of that 23% is passengers in cars and trucks. Cars do account for a lot of our greenhouse gas emissions. So looking at transportation in general, when we're thinking about a just transition off of fossil fuels, is really, really important. And public transportation in that overall, those greenhouse gas emissions from transit are not accounting for nearly as much. So public transit is a climate solution.
Like, we advocate more for transit, because probably both of you know, like the mainstream solution is to have more electric vehicles, like replace every gas vehicle for electric one. And we don't think that's the best solution. We don't need to support billionaires like Elon Musk. And a lot of what we do is try to expose people to more unconventional ideas, and focusing on transit is something you don't really hear that often. So there's a lot of stuff interconnected with that and it intersects with a lot of issues. And transportation is a key component to just transition off of fossil fuels more than, let's say, keeping car culture.
A lot of government climate plans so far have focused on providing rebates for electric vehicles. And as you've alluded to, that is not the approach that might be the best one. So I guess, can you talk about what some of the problems are with focusing on zero emission vehicles?
The whole point is that we don't want to perpetuate the current system as it is now. It mostly benefits car producers, car manufacturers that kind of got us in this predicament in the first place. It also kind of changes like the extractivist nature of things. So like before, we're extracting like oil with electric vehicles to make the batteries. We're extracting more like metals like lithium and cobalt. And usually that's done in like other countries where the working condition and exploitation is pretty bad. And we don't want to continue the cycle of exploitation. That's why like focusing more on transit instead of individualized vehicles is a better solution. Also like designing cities around public transportation instead of individual vehicles has like societal impacts where like there's more of a community vibe, like moving around with people, it gives you a bigger sense of community. So those are a few points as to why transit is better than like individual vehicles.
Yeah, the only thing I'll add there is that, like Ruben said, we're not disrupting the status quo at all by replacing all gas-powered vehicles with electric ones. What we're doing instead is just like perpetuating like colonial violence that this country is built on. And especially it would be colonial violence down south in South America, where a lot of the lithium and cobalt mining takes place. And actually, 76% of mining companies worldwide are owned by Canadian corporations. So we are the worst leader in that regard.
I'm wondering, when it comes to public transit, what are some of the challenges that cities like Montreal are facing right now?
Currently, we're collaborating with different groups who are rallying around transit. And in the discussions we have, one of the main points that come up is that financing is a big issue with the transit system in Montreal. Like, it's heavily underfinanced, underserviced, and things are only getting worse while the prices of fares are only getting more expensive, which is like a deterrent for like regular people who want to take more public transportation but are discouraged either by like the price or like the service. A lot of the initiative that's being done in the city and in the region is to have public transportation considered more like a right, to the equivalent of like healthcare or like education. Like, everyone should have access to public transportation to get around. And financing is a big part of it. And the governments are not really on board with that. So I'd say that's a big issue around transit.
Yeah, there's like overt antagonism towards public transit by the current provincial government here. And I would say that like that doesn't give our municipal government an out at all either. We see all levels of government as like differently culpable in this. Like, for example, Montreal's police budget last year was like $820 million. So we know there's money could be allocated differently. And we also know that public transit is super desirable. Not just anecdotally in Montreal, but like in a 2022 survey, the majority of Montrealers want shorter duration of trips and lower costs. And right now, with all the fare hikes that keep coming every year in like July, since we launched the campaign, Montrealers are paying more for a single fare than in Vancouver or Toronto, while like the median income is like 15 to 20,000 less compared to the two other major cities. So there's a lot of challenges, and it comes with like moving people in positions of power right now. The provincial government is drastically underfunding public transportation, that's for sure. And we need to organize around that as well. But like within our city, we know that like for example, there's a transit protest that we're co-leading tomorrow, and the municipal government's going to be there. and they're super happy to be there, and we're super not into them being there. But like, we know that we do have to have these like uncomfortable working relationships with people in power, but it's like, you're the problem too. But their messaging is all, the provincial government is underfunding us. Oh, woe is me. We can't do anything about it, when like you've almost given $1 billion to the cops every year.
It might be a good thing that they're there. That way they hear the missions, because our message is for them. So yeah.
Yeah, it's actually going to be really cool.
That's the point of a protest, to disrupt and be uncomfortable. Yeah.
There you go. Yeah. That actually is a really good lead into my next question, which is about the public transit campaign that Climate Justice Montreal launched in 2022. So can you talk a little bit about how that campaign got started and what it sort of achieved today?
It was launched in the wake of fare hikes that were coming in 2022 in the summer. And at that point, it was still very much taking shape. It was taking shape at the same time that another campaign that we were running since 2020 was kind of dying. It was a Just Recovery for Montreal. And that was like largely around coalition building with groups dealing with like racial inequality, poverty, migrant rights, accessibility, like truly an intersectional coalition. And so they kind of merged at one point, in the sense that transit kind of became this vehicle for this intersectional look at how we could transform our city and beyond. Also, I mean, important piece of context is that like our capacity as Climate Justice Montreal was just decimated during the pandemic. So a lot of rebuilding internally took place in the last few years. So like in terms of achievements, I would say that like we're reaching a point where we can start looking back and being like, yeah, we're achieving things. Like the strength of the campaign is really in our coalition building. And I'm sure Rubens can speak more to that within Montreal and broadly around Quebec as well. But yeah, it's definitely been a campaign that we've been encouraged by how many people are into it and how people want to join and support it. And it's reaching a point where I feel like personally, like it's built enough that I do think like momentum is coming, and we are going to start making noise in more tangible ways now that like the base has been built.
There's a new episode of Pullback. Listen to the rest of the interview at pullback.org, at harbingermedianetwork.com, or wherever you get your podcasts. You've been listening to Harbinger Showcase on your local campus and community radio station. This episode's been brought to you by Unrigged. Learn more about Canada's coalition of 27 progressive publishers and get all your progressive news, videos, and podcasts in one place at unrigged.ca. Follow us on Twitter at Harbinger Tweets and on Instagram at Media Harbinger and now Blue Sky for updates on new episodes, and subscribe to the Harbinger newsletter for a weekly Wednesday roundup from Canada's cross-country community of 83 socially and politically progressive podcasts. We'll see you back here next week for a new episode. Until then, I'm Harbinger Director Andre Goulet in Montreal. Now back to your regularly scheduled community radio station programming.
Necessity of broad ongoing education of like members of socialist parties and unions, and also workers generally. And what's interesting to me is that it didn't necessarily lead to kind of dogmatism and isolation, because it was paired with like a constant like rigorous desire to be organized and be in disciplined political forms. So I think seeing those like two things literally work like dialectically with each other is very interesting to me.
You can deny all the things I've seen, all the things I've discovered, but not for much longer. Because too many others know what's happening out there.
I want to believe.
Hi, this is David Duchovny, and you're listening to CJSF 90.1 Burnaby.
Do you know what your local wetland has done for you lately? Wetlands function like nature's kidneys, mitigating the impacts of floods and droughts, protecting our communities, and supporting food production. Despite representing 6% of the Earth's surface, wetlands store 33% of the planet's carbon. If you value life, thank a wetland. Learn about wetlands at work with Ducks Unlimited Canada at ducks.ca/wetlands.